everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you, with The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And boy, sometimes it gets really rough out there, you know? Today, we want to talk about things getting rough. I received an advanced book from a dear friend, one of my favorite authors, Daphne Rose Kingma. Daphne is she's a great writer, and she's written some very, very challenging books about love itself and the different ways to look at love. And The Future of Love was her book that I think really was so impressive. I recommend it strongly. It's about how people deal with problems in love. But her latest book, The 10 Things to Do When Life Falls Apart, just grabbed me. So I thought, time to call Daphne. So Daphne, are you on the air with us?
I am right here. Hey! I'm right here with you, Armand.
How nice.
It's wonderful to be with you again.
Yes, Daphne has been here in the studio with us, WBAI. But this is very interesting stuff, Daphne. Because
yes, I felt like it was time to respond to the anguish that people are going through. As you know, I've written so many books about love, but it seems, you know, the real circumstance of the moment is that so many people are suffering in so many ways, and I'm always moved to respond to what's happening at the moment, and so that's how I got to writing this book about living through crisis or difficult times.
And let's talk about some of the different kind of times. You ever get fired from a job? Boyfriend drops you? You lose your savings? Your house gets robbed? You get carjacked? Each of these things that happen, all of these things that happen, an illness, it's like one of life's challenges. One of the things I loved about your earlier book, The Future of Love, is you talked about, I don't know if you said it specifically, but so many couples believe they're never going to survive when one person cheats on the other person or steps out on them. And in your book, you frame a way of getting past that. You talk about that as part of the integration or the part of the growth of the couple. So in this one, you get the feeling when something happens to you, oh no, my life is over. You know, I lost that job, I got fired, and so on and so forth. What do you do when your life falls apart? How do you get up in the morning when your son has been diagnosed with autism? When you catch your daughter with drugs? When your job is in danger? When you lose your spouse to a sudden heart attack? Or your mother needs surgery? Each of us face crisis and loss in our own way, but most of us can relate to those moments when the best thing anyone could say is, go ahead and cry, just remember to breathe. Go ahead, Daphne.
That's right. Well, all of these things are, of course, significant crises. And what I've noticed a great deal lately is that people are often going through one of these huge things and then just the general difficulty of life, you know, straitened circumstances or bad weather or, you know, we seem to have challenges piled up on one another. And I think as I talk about in these 10 things in the book, the truth is that all of these challenges are part of life. They're part of the nature of human experience, and we can't change that because that's the way life is, although the heat's kind of turned up right now, it seems to me. But the really significant thing is, in what frame of mind can we go through these things? How do we negotiate them or navigate them emotionally and ultimately spiritually? Because if we just keep taking it in the chops and we don't have a way of either participating or understanding or recovering, we just get eaten up by these things. And so that's why I've tried to, you know, boil it down into 10 things that people can focus on as a way of moving through these excruciating challenges?
You know, the way you mentioned it, I was talking to a dear friend yesterday about how things get lodged in your system.
Oh, yes.
You know, when you get caught in a tragic event, that gets stuck somewhere inside you. It could get caught in your heart, could get caught in your stomach, it could get caught in your bowel, could get caught in your breathing.
Yes, it gets caught literally in your body, and of course the reason it does is because we are also an emotional body. We feel about these things that happen to us, and unless we have a way of actually moving those feelings through our body by doing emotional work, I always call it, then these things do get stuck in our body, and they take the form of illness, and they take the form of just, you know, degenerating us, as opposed to being an experience not only that we can live through, but in many instances really grow from.
As if there's new muscle emerges.
Exactly.
From this very thing, because they say what doesn't kill you will make you stronger.
Yes, exactly.
And you're saying virtually that by being successfully able to go through a trauma, you become a stronger person because you've been through trauma. That's one of the advantages of age. One of the advantages of being older is that hey, I've been through a lot. I've seen a lot.
We have resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing that I'm really pointing out in this book through the process of the 10 is that not only do we just survive what we've been through, you know, we make it through and we're survivors and we're strong, but there's actually a process of transformation available to us. We become more peaceful. We have more equanimity. We see our lives in a very different frame than we did before. And those are really, I would say, spiritual gains. In other words, our whole being is transformed in the way that we hold ourselves in life and the way we hold life in ourselves. And this is, I think, the real purpose of any of these difficulties that we go through.
Could you give me a common example of that? Let's try something like medical well-being or physical well-being and challenges like that, like a heart attack.
Well, of course, on a actual level, if people get the message of that and say, you know, my body is speaking to me, what is the message here? Do I need to slow down? Do I need to quit smoking? Do I need to start walking every day? Do I need to notice the beauties in my life? That, you know, there's a physical change that can happen, and there's a spiritual and emotional change that can happen, which is or can be that one becomes grateful for life, one sees that life is temporary and momentary and starts asking the questions of what is real about me, who am I going to be after I'm not here anymore, since I had such a close brush with death. And so the framework of experience and of perceiving life gets stretched, and you start to say, wow, there's more to me than just this body, and there's more to me than just this experience. And we begin to have a sense of, you know, what is ultimate and eternal and soulful in us through these experiences, if we pause to, you know, allow ourselves to go through them and to take the meaning that's being offered through these experiences. They're ordeals on one level, something that we need to deal with, but they're opportunities to see ourselves and life itself in a much larger frame.
Well, you know, one of the problems I see is that people go through something tragic, and then they do this kind of almost this phobic reaction. You know, oh, I had a heart attack, now I'm going to eat only nutritious food, and I'm going to be running, and I'm going to do exercise. And they compulsively go to correct it the same way the compulsion drove them into their illness.
Yes, that's true.
And so I think something's missing in that process.
Well, you're talking about my book, Armand, because there's a chapter on that, which I call Face Your Defaults, and that is we all have very familiar ways of coping with things. What you're just describing is a person whose way of coping is compulsive and controlling. I'm going to get the best of this. I'm going to handle this. I'm going to whip this into shape or whip myself into shape. And one of the true gifts and challenges of a difficult time is that you look at those ways that you've always been doing things and ask yourself, is this really the way to do it? The person who says, you know, I've had a heart attack, now I'm going to run 20 miles a day, might be exactly the person who needs to stop running and sit down and meditate. But if you don't pause to have this self-inventory that I talk about in the book, then you just go back to the same old thing and you don't receive the benefit or the transformation that the challenge is offering you. And I think, and I've seen, and I'm sure you have too, over and over again, when people face difficulty and they do it in a very deep and conscious way, they go through the emotions of it and they look at the spiritual opportunity of it, that they really become different people. So that, you know, the challenge always contains a gift, but if we don't pay attention, we don't receive the gift. And, you know, I'd like to sort of just in an introductory way run through a couple of the topics in this book just so people have a sense of where we're going and what the opportunities are here.
Sure. And before we do that, I remember a good friend of mine, one of my teachers, said to me once, there is no rebirth unless there's a death.
And
he said to me, this is Salvatore Roquette, he said to me, unless you have the experience of a true death of something, you're not going to feel a rebirth, a different change. He said, so simply just changing things without dying doesn't make it work. He said, you got to go through the death of it. And he meant the pain of the death of it. You have to grieve it. You have to let it go. And you got to leave yourself fallow so that you could let some new thing be born.
Beautifully spoken. Yes. That's so true and wonderful. And, of course, all of these deep challenges that we go through, that people are going through, especially, I think, right now, really are, to put it bluntly, an opportunity for that death and transformation. But, you know, we're all scaredy cats. We don't want to go through the death part because that's scary. We don't know what lies on the other side of it. Will we be reborn? Will be, you know? I mean, I think there's always, we always step up to that brink with fear, and yet when we surrender and pass through it, there are great riches to be received.
Well, my guest is Daphne Rose King, by the name of the book, The 10 Things to Do When Your Life Falls Apart, a good book to carry when you're going on vacation. You know, Daphne, though, you talk about that, and there's something that I always notice when people get a major challenge. When they have a major challenge, people cry, but they don't weep. People don't let the emotion pass through. They don't allow the dislodging. They may grieve, and they may scream and cry and get angry, but it's not the weeping that happens.
That's a really great distinction, Armand. Well, you're speaking about the very first chapter of the book, which I call Cry Your Heart Out, which is a real invitation and direction to people. I guess I mean weeping by cry your heart out. In other words, you can't just have a nanosecond of tears and feel like you've really, nothing has been cleansed then. And I think we just live in a culture that tells us every which way we're supposed to be happy every minute, and if we're not, we're supposed to take a pill so we can be. And the concept of grief as a doorway, grief as a death experience, and a birth experience is something that we really don't have, you know, generally available to us. And that's why I made it the very first chapter in the book, because by golly, if you're going through some horrible thing, you really do need to cry about it, and you need to feel entitled to cry about it, and you need to let those tears come and pour, because it's not just an emotional release, but, well, an emotional release is always a physical release, but it's the way that those feelings get dislodged from your body and you're restored to a state of equanimity and, you know, physical equanimity, so that you have the energy to deal with whatever it is that you're dealing with.
Tears are the sweat of the heart.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
It's like
they're very renewing.
When your heart is working, and if your heart breaks, it should sweat. and it, you know, or if it bleeds and it comes out through your tears. And so now there are the people who cry hysterically and get deeply depressed, and then they go into a closet for a long period of time and never want to come out again. And then there are people who cry differently. And I believe you and I are both talking about a different experience of crying. There's a crying that's open.
Yeah,
it feels open. It feels like my eyes are pouring out. It feels like there's nothing stopping the lacrimal glands from supplying me with every bit of water from the inside of my body that's available. Yeah. I am crying because the pain is so intense. But I'm not blocking the pain. And I have a suspicion that the big paroxysms of crying, those deep, deep paroxysms, the ones that sound like you're screaming, are not as intense as the ones where you're just letting yourself cry. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's not as big. So sometimes I think people make tears too big. And I remember a woman, Rivka Zala, told me a story about when she was a kid and she lived in Romania. And she said when she was in Romania, her parents would go off to work, and she was at home alone. And she said she would watch them. She was a little girl, 5 or 6 years old. And she said she would watch them walking off to go to work. And she'd be in the house, and she'd start crying. And she said she'd cry, and she'd cry, and she'd cry. And then she'd peek up to see if the crying had left yet. And then if it didn't leave, she'd cry, and she'd cry, and she'd cry. And then if it didn't leave yet, she cried some more. And then finally the crying left, and she was okay. Mm-hmm. I have another friend who told me about when she became premenstrual. She always said, I always feel like I'm on the edge of tears, but I can't go there. Mm-hmm. So she would rent terrible movies like Sophie's Choice. She said, I'd watch them, and I'd bring myself to the deepest tears so that I could let that pass out of my body.
Yes, well, these are all stories about the power of tears, the power of crying. It isn't, as so many people say, I'm sure you've heard this, I've heard it so many times, you know, people start crying and they say, I'm sorry.
You apologize, right.
As if somehow they should be able to contain and control this. And, of course, they're really cutting off that healing process. And I think the fact that so many people makes that apology is really a reflection of, you know, what we've put out in our culture, that we're always supposed to keep it together, you know, we're always supposed to have the lid on, we're always supposed to be pulling ourselves through the knothole of life without having any emotional reaction. So if you're going through a very hard thing, the very first thing to do is let the tears come and let them. I love that story about your friend. You know, as a child, she was even saying, I got to cry this out, you know. Uh-huh. And when I'm done crying, then I'll be able to do something here. But until I'm finished, I've got to be in that process. And so this is really here right at the beginning of the book to give people permission to grieve about whatever it is they're going through. It's worth your tears, and your tears are a necessary part of the healing.
So if you're with somebody who's going through that, one of the things, the tendency to do is to say, don't cry. Right? What a terrible thing to do to somebody. You know,
yes, what a terrible thing to do. But, you know, you're bringing up a really important thing, Armand, because so many people don't know how to be with people who are crying. And the advice on that is very simple. It's just this. Let them cry. The crying will come to its own natural conclusion.
Right.
It will tell you when it's finished. And just be present with the person who's crying. They don't need you to do anything. They don't need you to tell it's going to be all right or that they should stop or get over it. But just let that process unfold in its natural way.
I know so many therapists who, if a person starts to cry, they ask the person, why are you crying? As opposed to saying, go ahead, go through that.
Right.
I mean, as a therapist, if you ask a person, why are you crying, you're asking them to intellectualize that experience
exactly.
of cleansing.
And interrupt it.
Yeah, fire that therapist.
Yeah.
Get another one.
Yeah.
Why are you crying? So step one is to let a person go through the not only catharsis, but I'm sure there's a lot of emotional, physical stuff that takes place. But there's a cleansing that seems to take place with the tears. That's the first step of your, that you believe in.
Yes, that's a rebirth. And these things, by the way, these 10 things are, of course, they had to come in some order, but, and they do sort of move through a process, but it's really the 10 aspects that a person needs to go through when they're going through something difficult. Another is the thing that we talked about a few minutes ago, which is to look at how you habitually deal with problems. I call that facing your defaults. We all have these kind of knee-jerk ways that we go through life, you know, like the compulsive runner is going to compulsively run again after his heart attack. So it's very important to examine these things because they're related to the pain of our childhood and how we coped as children, and somehow or sometimes they're not the right way to solve the problem, you know, especially if you've gotten into some sort of habitual or addictive thing, you know, well, I feel bad, I'll have a drink, or well, I'm going to take up smoking again, or, you know, I'm going to eat myself into oblivion. I mean, these are very obvious ones, but it's like your teacher said, we have to go through the death experience. In other words, and part of that is in times of crisis often a death of the way we've handled things. You know, it's like the person who's, you know, always have wads of money to spend and says, okay, I'm having a bad day, I'm going to go buy myself a goodie. You know, that's not maturing you in any way. And so it's very often we've got to stop and look at how we've handled things, and that moves on to the very next thing, which is to do something different.
Well, let's go back to a minute for facing your defaults.
All right.
All right, because facing your defaults, this is Daphne's second step, which is not necessarily the order that that is going to come in. But I've always had a way of handling bad news. And one of the things that you're saying is, how have you always handled this in the past? Buckaroo Banzai once said, if you do what you've always done, you're going to get what you always got.
Right.
And the question is, every time I've broken up with somebody or I had a bad relationship, I went out and got drunk. Every time I did this, the default is what you're talking about, that you kind of, there's a common position that you always go to when you've had pain.
Yes.
And you're saying, look at that one.
Right.
And now you're saying step into something different.
Yes. And you know, it's like therein lies the opportunity for growth here. In other words, just to take a wild example, you know, the person who's always handled the wealthy person who's always handled difficulty by saying, you know, I'm going to go out and buy myself a something, who then says, why did I always do that? What is that related to in my childhood? I never had an experience of love, but my parents had money. They always gave me things. Therefore, I do the same thing. But there's an opportunity for a turnaround here, and that person might, in fact, there's a story in this book that's kind of along these lines, that person might say instead, what I really need to do is go take care of some other people who are in need instead of indulging myself. There's the turnaround of doing something different when you face your defaults. And, of course, the minute you do that new thing, you do have a different experience. And that person who's always felt unloved because they were always being indulged or indulging themselves now suddenly has an experience of love because they're connecting with other people.
It's so hard to get outside of yourself when you're in pain.
It is so hard
it's
to get
so
outside
hard
of yourself.
Remember that you're part of a human race.
Yes, and that really, Armand, you know, I, the love doctor, that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, because people do lose their sense of connection, not just with others, but with themselves. And so, you know, this whole path that I've laid out in the book is a way of remembering that above all, these very hard things that we go through are an invitation for us to reconnect and to, you know, deeply be aware of our interconnectedness.
No, that's an interesting thing, Daphne, because if you think about it, almost every one of the things that cause us the greatest amount of pain are some attempt of our manipulation to develop a a kind of a power that we wanted to have, whether it be strength, whether it be love, whether it be possessions, economy. We're really trying to manipulate the variables so that we could exceed. And when they fall apart, when something falls apart, when we're wounded narcissistically, when our love walks out on us, when we find out our mate has cheated on us, when we, all of these things that throw us into the pit kind of say to us, you're alone and you're the only person and you're right. Alone and you're, and it reminds us of this attempt we had to try to be this alone superior self. And what happens when you step out of that is you wind up feeling totally alone.
Yeah.
And it's all an illusion. Mm-hmm. We're not alone. The minute I picked up Daphne's book and looked at it today, what did I do? Got on the phone and called her. I said, wait, that's one of my favorite connections out there.
Yes, and I think, you know, as you said a few minutes ago, Armand, you know, when people are suffering, it's so easy to feel isolated and to not take that next step, the do something different step of saying, who can I reach out to? How can I, you know, how can I transform this situation? Because there's always a choice we can make.
Wow.
We can make the choice to sit there in our misery, or we can make the choice to join someone else. And even, and especially actually, when we join someone else who's suffering, we have a sense of gratitude, we have a sense of connection, we don't feel alone, and you know, that's a step that so often people forget. You know, it takes a little extra commitment and insight to say, I can reach out, you know, I can speak to someone, I can reach over to someone, I can serve someone.
I remember a man who got fired around Christmas, and he said he went down by the water and he cried. He just cried. He couldn't take it. He was let go his entire life. He was fired because he was too old. He
wow.
was fired because they didn't want him. They just let him go. And so he felt totally, totally useless. And he said he was down around the South Street Seaport. And he was like walking around just down by the water. And he walked into a church where they were serving homeless. And he asked if he could help. Oh. And he helped serve soup.
Oh.
And he said, beautiful. He said, it was the greatest gift I ever received.
Yeah.
Because then it was just everything like you said, do something different. My guest is Daphne Rose King, where she's going to be with us for a little while longer, but we are going to have to take a short break. Daphne, don't leave us.
I'm right here.
In Santa Barbara, California, of all places where it's kind of beautiful right now at 10 o'clock in the morning or so. So we're going to take a very short break, my friends, and when we come back, a tiny bit of music and more of this wonderful interview with Daphne Rose Kingma, K-I-N-G-M-A, who wrote The 10 Things to Do When Your Life Falls Apart. So let me see now. We also have, Daphne, I just wanted to mention one other thing that people I'm sure are going to check on the book, the love book that you wrote, the first one.
Well, the first book I wrote was Coming Apart, which is about ending relationships. You were talking a few minutes ago about a book called The Future of Love, The Power of the Soul in Intimate Relationships.
Now, was it The Future of Love that was your second book?
Well, it was actually my eighth book or my,
oh my
ninth
gosh.
Book. I've been a busy girl. But that book really talks about, you know, unsettling and amazing changes that are happening in relationships, and looks at all of that from a spiritual perspective. It's like, what's really going on? Why are we having these unusual configurations of relationships? And it's all about, you know, it's all about the soul consciousness in us that's really trying to wake us up to love.
Yeah, which would, and part of that love is more internal. We're going to be back with you in just a couple of minutes, my friends. Back with Daphne Rose Kingma. And this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Back with you with Daphne Rose Kingma, author of The 10 Things to Do When Your Life Falls Apart. when tragedy happens, when something happens that you think you can't get past. So far, Daphne has said to us, number one, when you feel the pain, cry your heart out. Cry your heart out. Number two, face your defaults. Number three, do something different. Where do we take it from there, Daphne?
Well, it's a process that then says, let go. How about that? Letting go is a very general thing when you're in a rough time. You never know what you're going to have to let go of, but when we're going through difficulties, we tend to hold on, you know, to cling to the whatever, to the way things were, to the way we want it to be, to the stuff, the whatever. And so letting go is really a process of surrender as we're going through a difficulty. It's like we've got to surrender into the experience, and we've got to let go of the things that we're holding on to, because otherwise we can't move through the process and get to a new place, you know? It's just like in death, you have to let go of your body to get to whatever comes next, and in life, you have to let go of whatever you're holding on to get whatever comes next.
I know a wonderful man who was talking about, he had a new position, he sold one business, he built this new huge house. With he, his wife, and his kids, they loved this new house. It was a wonderful house. But the house was kind of based on the fact that their business was going to be successful. And it turned out that his business deal fell through. So he had to sell the house. And he said the following. He said, you can't imagine how wonderful it was to let go of the new house.
Wow.
He said it was because the house had with it all the burdens, all the responsibilities, all the maintenance, all the design. He said, and when I let that go, it was like a gift. It was like a gift. Oh,
what
I'm going to live a simpler life.
What a beautiful teaching. And to hear somebody actually say that, because there is an incredible liberation and freedom in letting go, you know. And that's such a beautiful example of it. And yet, again, it's one of those things when we're standing on the brink of it, our tendency is to want to hold on. But when we let go, it's when the liberation can occur.
So letting go is a process where you take... See, I believe that we identify ourselves by certain things, and I believe narcissism is at the root of most of the prolonged pain that people feel. I think when we're young, people say to themselves, I'm going to define myself somehow. I'm either going to be rich, I'm going to be smart, I'm going to be sexy, I'm going to be happy, I'm going to have children, I'm going to have a house. And these become part of this imaginary self that you have. And then something cracks it. Something says, no, you're not so pretty. No, you're not so rich. No, you're not so successful. No, you're not so smart. And what we try to do is we try to hold on to that old image. Oh, yes, I am. Yes, I am. Yes, I am. I think part of what you're suggesting, Daphne, is as I've known you over the years, what you suggest is let go of that image. Forget it.
Yes.
You don't have
yes.
to be smart. You don't
yes.
have to be rich.
Let go of the pieces that you think you can't let go of, and then you can make an amazing discovery.
Well, I think you have to, in order to do that, you have to recognize step number five.
Oh, I think you're reading along with me, Armand. Step number five is to remember who you've always been. And what I really mean by that is that, you know, when people get in a state of crisis, they really feel like, you know, they're powerless and they don't have anything to bring to it. And it's like, oh, my goodness, I'm suddenly in this situation that's bigger than I am, and how am I going to get through it? And I don't have the money or the brains or the time or the energy to get through it. And yet each of us has some personal power that's very significant. I call it your signature strength. Everybody has this. And it's a way people have of, you know, it's actually what in each of us has allowed us to survive. You know, it's the adaptation. It's the brilliance in each of us. And, of course, this quality, which is intrinsic to you, is a continuous gift in your nature in life, and it will come to your rescue now. You know, it's what you can count on. But it's amazing, and I'm sure you've noticed this, too, that so many people have absolutely no idea of how they're operating or how they've gotten from A to G in their life. And so with this chapter, I'm really inviting people to pause and take note of that. Take note of the riches that you are.
How do you get to recognize your signature strength? Like, if I remember you, you dance the tango. Mm-hmm. No, but that's not your signature strength.
How did you remember that?
Hey,
your signature
Daphne.
Strength is remembering. I'm impressed.
Hey, Daphne, what is Argentine tango, too?
That's right.
That's right. Daphne, what is your signature strength, besides the fact that you wrote 472 books?
Well, I think my signature strength is to be moved by life and to have the words to translate that. I'm a very deep participator in life, and I'm always willing to go through the experience that life is offering and then to translate it into words, whether that's speaking or writing or doing the emotional healing work I do with people in my office, you know, what we fondly call therapy. So it's that relationship of being willing to experience life and turning my experience into words that are meaningful to people.
I think it's more than words, too, because there's a connection that you have with people that's just plain old significant. You know, I mean, you connect. I know I've seen you on Oprah. I've seen you on TV. You're there, you know. It's a connection. So if I were to say signature strength, Daphne Rose Kingma, she participates,
you know. Beautiful. Yes, yes. And I think, you know, that's a lovely compliment, Armand. Thank you. I think that capacity to connect with others really comes from my capacity and my willingness to connect with life. That, you know, we can only connect with others. We can only empathize and be present and, you know, allow other people to feel that we are with them in some profound way if we've allowed ourselves to be affected by life. And I think, you know, I can remember back to my infancy, literally. I have conscious memories of my infancy. And so I am a person who has participated, and I think that's a gift that I bring, too.
What do you remember about your infancy?
Well, I can remember lying in my crib and noticing the bars of it, and I can remember the shadows on the window in my room when I was a child. There were very beautiful windows in my room that had wonderful wooden arches in them, and I remember going to sleep and seeing that vision and how enchanting that was, and watching the night go down and being mystified by that process that the day would come to an end. And so, you know, I have memories of being fed and of my brother coming to pick me up in the middle of the night, and beautiful memories of being a little kid and playing in the backyard. So I have this continuous experience of the sounds, the visions, the, you know, things that I was involved. Wow, I'm going on a whole trip here. Don't get me started.
I want to hear. I love it.
You know, little dresses that I wore, little sunsuits that I wore, you know, playing in the dirt by the front steps outside of my house in Philadelphia with my sister, and, you know, lemonade on summer afternoons, and the sound of the screen door, and the lightning bugs and the jars. I mean, it just goes on and on.
So you would say that part of that nurturing childhood that you had, which included wild strawberries, I'm sure.
It did.
I know. It had to. That part of that childhood of yours, Well, there was something odd about you, though, Daphne. You were not like the other kids. You weren't from day one. I know there were a lot of kids around, but you're different. No, I'm serious. I don't mean that as a joke. You know, you were different. You did stand out in your own way, didn't you? Weren't you the unusual child?
I think that's true, and as I came from a large family, I'm the youngest of five children, and I was the only blonde and blue-eyed person in my family, so that was a pretty obvious difference.
Pretty obvious genetic picking there,
you know
what I mean?
Yes, it was. I'm the fruit of the recessive gene.
Yeah, right here.
But So there was a very visible difference, and I think probably my nature is different too. I mean, we're all different, but I think that, and maybe the fact that I was different in such a visible way, you know, brought different responses to me and allowed me to respond to life differently too. I'm sure that's true.
But you have that kind of curiosity about life, that endless curiosity about
that where is it? I do. That I do. I love the experience of being alive, and I love even the painful experiences of being alive because they deepen me, and they deepen me in myself, and they deepen me in how I can relate to other people too. So there's an incredible richness in that. I've never been a person to want to avoid the depth of the experience. People often say to me, while we're getting so personal, people often say to me that they sense I've had a very fascinating life. And I suppose in the abstract that's true, you know, just in the objective saying, you know, I've traveled a lot and I've had a lot of relationships and I've had a lot of experiences and I've written a lot of books, so that makes for an interesting life. But I think the real thing has been that I've been blessed to really be open to the depth of the experience, whatever that is.
Which includes the pain.
Rich. Yes,
which includes the pain, because the difference that we found, we did a study, the difference between men and boys. And when I say boys, I mean adolescents. Adolescents are always escaping pain. They're always running from the pain. They don't want to feel it. Whereas the adult says, okay, if this comes with pain, I'm willing to feel it.
Mm.
And being willing to go through the pain gives you such a different richness. And people don't want you to go through it. They want you to get away from it. But I think, to me and to you, pain's a part of it.
Yes. There's an old saying, I don't know where it came from, but it's a 17th century saying, which is this: when the pain is gone, the patient is dead. And I think that attests, you know, to the fact, what you were just saying, that pain is a part of our human experience, and it's what allows us to see the beauty, because it provides the contrast. And if we're always trying to eliminate that part, we just have this very blah life. I mean, we know that the beauty in art and the beauty in literature is because we see this contrast. We see the contrast between the beautiful moments and the agonizing moments. And therein lies the exquisite tapestry of life.
So accepting that life and all of its problems will have a pain. So, and I think of the horror of things like a person losing their child,
yes,
you know, the death of a child. And you're trying to wait till you get over the pain. No, the pain is a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
That pain is a part of that whole existence. You don't just get over your pain. You live with your pain.
There's an amazing story about the Dalai Lama. He was with a young monk, and I can't remember just what the circumstance was, but I don't know if he was training the young monk or... Anyway, the young monk became very overwhelmed and discouraged and ultimately committed suicide. And someone said to the Dalai Lama, "How did you ever get over that?" And he said, "I have not gotten over it." And I think what he's saying there is the things that are pain in our life, we don't get over. They become part of the tapestry of our life. It's not like, well, someday you wake up 20 years later and you erase it. It's still there as part of the fabric of your being. And because it's there, you become more compassionate, you become a greater soul, you become more generous, you become more loving, you become more humble, you become more peaceful. So, I mean, that I think one of the biggest things that has gone on in this country is that we've all sold ourselves this mess of pottage that we should never feel bad and we shouldn't have bad experiences. And we've had all these billions of self-help books that have told us we can have all the money we want and all the people we want and all the love we want. And, you know, we can do all this stuff to our bodies so that we can have the bodies we want. We can have gastric bypass surgery and we can do this, that, and the other thing. And it's like we're not allowing room for that dimension of life that is the tragic dimension, which is the balance of everything. And so really, in a way, this book is a call to say, yes, embrace these difficulties in your life and know that you have the power to move through them and that they will move through you and you will be transformed by them. And that we got to stop running away and being so ashamed of the things that are difficult for us, because they're part of human experience. They're part of the fabric of life. And it's not that they're not supposed to happen. It's how are we going to go through this experience?
If you're going to limp, then limp. If it's going to hurt you, then it's going to hurt you.
Yeah.
What about persistence, though? You know, there's people are so likely to quit.
Well, that's right. People are likely to quit when they, you know, they're faced with something difficult.
Show me the next boyfriend, you know. Show me the next, let me jump into something else. Give me some drugs.
Right. And so persisting is really about a willingness to move through the process that's happening to you. It's persisting to get through it. Yes, of course we need to get through these things. We do need to ultimately get over our grief about the loss, and we do need to find another job eventually, and we do need to, you know, stick to the diet, and we do need to build a new house and a life after we've lost a house. But it's like in the process of going through it, you can't just bail out and say, I quit, I'm going to give up because it's too hard or it's too long or it's too amazing. It's very interesting. When I was writing this book, it's a book, of course, about going through difficult times. I have never had so many things pile up on me in the process of writing a book. And, of course, I believe that spiritually the reason for that was that I needed to be in a state of crisis myself. So I wasn't just a bag of hot air telling everybody it's a piece of cake to get through it. And for starters, for example, I had this book completely outlined and ready to write. I went on a trip to Maui, where I often go to write. I was exhausted from preparing the book, and I stayed in a little hotel, and I got up the next morning and went out to my car, and my computer and the entire book outline, which was handwritten, had been stolen. So very starting out...
Stolen,
gone, vanished, wow. Over, done. And so, I mean, when I'm talking about persisting, it's like at that point I could have said, well, I didn't want to write that book anyway, or this is too hard, or obviously it wasn't meant to be. I mean, I had a very strong conviction about writing this book, that it was the next book I should write, that it was my response to the suffering that I see going on with people, that there was a message of love in it. And, you know, there was nothing I could do. And basically, I had to start over. I mean, I had to start and sit with a notebook and write by hand, and I had to recapture the thoughts that I wanted to write, and I had to go buy a new computer, of course. And so it's like, but at any point along the way in a crisis, you want to bail out, you know. It's like, okay, now there's another hard thing. I was traveling home from a meeting about this book, and a huge deer ran into my car and just about ran me off the road. I thought I'd broken my collarbone, and I had to go to the hospital and have it examined. It was just cracked, and obviously I was okay. But I'm saying, you know, when you're in a state of crisis, and I think that's one of the reasons the word crisis often applies, because it's not just an isolated thing. It's the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, and you think, oh my goodness, how am I going to go through the next layer of things that's just been piled on here? But we do need to keep quietly moving forward, because it's like, it is like the birth process. It isn't instantaneous. It's, you know, it's an ongoing process in which we must step forward again and again and again, and then finally you get to the next place. And it's the trudging part of the journey.
Crisis does seem to multiply itself.
It does.
When you think, I can't take anymore. People ask me, you know, how I'm doing, if I've got stuff going wrong with me. I like to say I've got 5% more to spare. I can take 5% more than I have right now. I just like to keep it in perspective that every time I think I'm overwhelmed, there's a lot more room inside me. There's a lot more room.
Yes. And we discover that, and that is part of the gift of persistence, is that we discover our capacity to expand and to be contained more than we could. And then as a process of a consequence of that persistence, we get to see something about our true nature. You know, we get to see how strong we are, or how generous we are, or how flexible we are, or, you know, and we become more generous or more flexible or more loving as a consequence of persisting.
Well, we've got just a few more minutes, and I'm going to ask you for your final solution, which I know you're not going to have other than go where the hazelnuts are.
That's adorable. I used to pick wild hazelnuts.
I know, wild hazelnuts and blackberries. You couldn't find them anywhere. Try to find me real blackberries nowadays.
Yes, isn't that the truth? Well, I don't want to... We've talked about a lot of the topics, and I think that we don't need to go through all of them.
No, but what about where the love is?
The really bottom line of all this is to look for the love in these situations, to align yourself with other people, to give your love to other people, because as we said earlier, that's really where the healing comes. And ultimately, to take this whole experience and to look at it from a spiritual perspective. I kind of hate that word. It's been so overused lately, spiritual this, that, and the other thing. But what I really mean by that when I talk about living in the light of your own spirit is, like, get in touch with the fact that there is more to you than just this mortal human being who's going through the paces of life. And that there is an eternal and soulful essence in you that is bigger than all of this experience. And when we see that, then everything, well, for one thing, everything becomes kind of glowing. And for another thing, we recognize very deeply that we have the capacity to go through whatever we're going through. And so these are the ultimate gifts and riches of these horrible experiences that we go through from time to time. And this book is a journey that you know, takes people through some of the paces, but ultimately brings you to the reminder of this truth, which is where the real peace lies.
The book is The 10 Things to Do When Your Life Falls Apart, Daphne Rose Kingma. You know, Daphne, one last statement. When you say go where the love is, that doesn't mean go where people are loving you. It doesn't mean that, even though that may be a part of it. It means find your own love and go there.
Yes, exactly. Go to that love inside yourself. And Armand, I'd like to say, of course, this book is available on Amazon and in lots of bookstores. And my website, I'd like to mention for
which
all
is
those
fun.
Other books.
Go to Daphne's website because she's beautiful to look at as well.
Thank you. It's www.daphne, D-A-P-H-N-E, Kingma, K-I-N-G-M-A.com. Two names that are hard to spell.
Daphne, thanks again. Looking forward to see you when you come to New York.
A great joy to speak with you, Armand.
Bye-bye for now.
Bye.
And this is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We have to be going, but we will be back with you soon, my friends. Just be sure we're here. If you want to hear this again, go to thepositivemind.com or wbai.org.